My name is Nicole Bridge. Can you like everybody hear me okay? Perfect. Okay. So thank you all for being here on a Tuesday night. Hopefully, as Sheila said, you're on your break, but if you're not, I appreciate you spending an hour with me. I'm really excited to talk to you tonight. So this idea of mass identity was a journey of learning that began for me about 3 years ago when I got to attend some professional development through the Science Museum of Minnesota. And they do a lot of work with access and equity conversations and use STEM as the vehicle. Well, they spent about half a day during one session talking about mass identity, and it burrowed its way into my brain the way that few things kind of ever have. And so that's where we are today. So let's get started. So identity is a personal thing, and so I want you to have a moment of personal reflection. Throughout the session, by the way, there are going to be moments where I ask you to do some personal reflection. That can look like a number of things. You're welcome to use the chat window to do that. If it's a personal reflection question, not one you necessarily want an answer to, just indicate that as we go along. So tonight, let me start with our learning targets. We're going to start with talking about what is mass identity and how it develops. We're also going to talk about the role that we as teachers play in shaping students' mass identities. And then we're going to start just the very sort of tip of the iceberg around identifying strategies to help create positive mass identities in our students. So here's what I want you to do. Take just a moment in the chat window, on a sheet of paper, quietly in your brain, whatever you need to do, and I want you to think about this. Are you a mass person? However you identify, how do you know? Meaning, who told you or how did you know? And then what does that mean to you and what does it mean about you? So I'll give you about a minute. Okay. So if we're going to have a conversation about mass identity, I want to make sure that we all have a common definition of identity that we're starting from. So when I talk about identity, it's a couple of pieces. So first of all, there's this idea of our personal identity, this idea of what I know about myself. But then there's this other aspect that we call social identity, that it's how I see myself based on how I think you see me. So this idea that I know that I might be a Republican because I believe in small government, I believe in large military, things like that, but this idea that there's this social aspect of when I say I'm a Republican, the way that people see me and the things that come on top of that, if that can make some sense. So it's important to note that we as individuals don't have one self, we have many selves. So not only do we have this idea of what I know about myself and what I think other people see about me, but then we also have this whole host of identities, and here is just a very short list of identities that we walk with every single day. When I'm talking about gender here, I'm talking about the social construct of what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman. When I talk about sex, I'm talking about biology. When I say race here, I'm talking about kind of those big buckets of categories we tend to put people into, the boxes we have them check. Whereas ethnicity, I'm defining here a bit more like culture. Now, notice with all of these that these can change throughout our lives. So things like age are changing every year. Social class, religion, these are things that can change all throughout our lives. It's also important to note that these identities intersect and inform one another. So, for example, I am a woman in the United States of America. Thinking about what it means to be a woman in the United States, well, that might be different than what it means to be a woman in China or a woman in Iran, right? So, also, I'm a woman who is 35 years old. how does that inform the way I think about myself as a woman when I was 15 versus when I'm 65, how I will think about those. So these are things that interweave and intersect all the time. And they're complex. And think about this, our students come with all of these identities too. That's really important to note that as I'm thinking about these things, I have to remember my students have these things too. Now, I don't like to have a conversation about identity without talking about privilege, because privilege is so very much informed by identity. When I was growing up, when someone would use the word privilege, I would think a lot about financial privilege. That's kind of the only way I thought about that word. I would think about the kids who got a car when they were 16 years old because they had some financial privileges that my family didn't have. But I want to be clear, that's not how I'm defining the word here. Here I'm talking about a special right or advantage awarded to a person or a group of people. And oftentimes, these are unlearned, unconscious, and unasked for. This word can be super loaded in certain situations in our world today, in the United States right now especially. And so I want to be clear that when I'm talking about privilege, as I talk about the privilege that I have as a white person or that I have as a heterosexual person, this is not something that I'm walking around saying that you should feel guilty about. It's more about recognizing what it is and knowing how it impacts my life and the way that I walk in the world. That's really what this conversation is about. So let's talk about this for a second. I think for me it's often easier to hear stories, and I think someone tell a lot of stories today. So this is a picture of me, and this is a picture of my husband. We are standing in front of a house that we bought a few years ago, and this is our obligatory, we just bought a house selfie. You'll notice he's quite tall, and he's also brown. His mother's family is from Mexico. His father is from Sri Lanka. So I show this picture, and I'm telling this story because life is really funny. So I first did this presentation about 3 years ago in Duluth, Minnesota at the Minnesota State Math Conference. And at that time, we had just bought this house. We were shopping for furniture. So we had been to a number of furniture stores together. And my experience shopping for furniture I never had given it much thought as to why this was my experience, was that the salespeople were always kind of right on top of me in the store. How can I help you? What do you need? They were helpful to the point of being overbearing. I've even had the experience with my husband where the two of us were there, and the salesperson said, if you need me, I'll be right over here. And then they tracked with us about 10 or 15 feet away, but they stayed like in a parallel line with us as we moved through the store in case we needed them. So that's my experience. The night before I gave this presentation in Duluth, my husband texted me and said, boy, it's a very different experience going to these furniture stores without you. And I said, well, what does that mean? And he said, well, I had a half day at work today. And he had gone into work. It was casual Friday. So he was wearing, I think, a polo shirt and jeans. And he had walked in the same stores we had been in together, and not a single person talked to him. He went to two different stores. He was in each store about 20 to 30 minutes, maybe even a little bit more in the one. And not a single person approached him. Not a single person talked to him. In fact, in one store, he didn't even see any salespeople. And so I thought, wow, why is that? That's not my experience. And I asked him, tell me more about that. And he said, it's about the perception of who can pay and who cannot. When you work on commission, you want to spend your money with someone you think will spend money, and you don't want to waste time with someone who you think won't. And if you're sitting there thinking, well, okay, but maybe it was just he was a man shopping without a woman, and women make a lot of the design decisions. Well, I've had that question asked before, and so I went to my husband and I said, what do you think about this? And he said, you know, that might be true, but I have enough data points in my life to tell me that there was something else going on there. This idea that the perception that I look a certain way and that I can pay, and that he looks another way and that he might not be able to pay. Let me give you another example of privilege. For the last several minutes, I've been telling you stories about my husband. I have referred to him as my husband. I showed you a picture. I don't even know if I told you, but his name is Nate, so I can tell you his name. And through all of this, I never once worried that you would think that I was perverse or trying to corrupt you or trying to indoctrinate you into my way of life. And I would say to you that my homosexual friends don't always enjoy that same privilege of talking freely about their family. I have friends who, when they got engaged, they told the one family, but they didn't tell the other because they just didn't want to feel hurt or upset about this happy thing that was going on in their lives, and they weren't sure how their families would react. I wasn't worried about how my parents would react, but my friends who are gay have a different experience. I have another friend who is a teacher and would wear his wedding ring to school, but he never referred to his partner by name. He always referred to him as my wife. His partner doesn't identify that way, but for the ease of conversation, he would refer to him as my wife. That's the privilege I'm talking about. This idea that by virtue of being heterosexual, I can speak freely about my family. I also like to pull an example of privilege from kind of the world outside of myself for these conversations as well. And I don't have to look too far very often in our world to find it. I'm going to tell you a story about that happened about a month ago. It was a blog post that was sort of circulating around my friends on Facebook and Twitter that I follow. So we've got a woman named Tiffany Martinez. She wrote a blog post documenting how she begins the blog post telling you about her credentials, how she's a McNair Scholar. She's presented at several conferences. She's been in college for a while. She's working on advanced degrees. And as a result, has written numerous papers, academic or just for lit classes or whatever. She's written a lot of papers. And she tells a story about how one morning this past November, her professor, in front of the whole class, called her up to turn back her paper and said to her, at the top of her paper, it said, "This is not your language. Please indicate where you've copied and pasted." She was very confused by that because she had not done that at all. And so she turned to the second page of the paper, and you can see a picture of it here on the screen. The professor circled the word "hence" and wrote, "This is not," underlined twice, "your word." And she was puzzled by that. And I have to tell you, I went to high school, I've been to college, and I've written numerous papers, and I think the day that I discovered the word "hence" was a pretty awesome day, actually, because then you realize how, yes, I can get away with a lot of sentences that way, and then the day you discover the word "moreover" is even a better day in your life. But never once has anyone questioned that I was plagiarizing someone else's work. And I think it's easy for us to say, well, this professor is just racist. And yes, that's an act of racism. But it makes me wonder if the professor was even outwardly trying. There's this implicit bias he didn't even know existed. And so she says here in her post, "My professor assumed that someone like me would never use language like that." And further down, she says, "There are students, and I, Nicole Bridge, am one of them, who will be assumed to be capable without having to list their credentials. My professors never once questioned me because of what I look and sound like, because of what my last name is. She has a different experience." That's what I'm talking about when I talk about privilege. So, let's think through this real quick and summarize. Our identities are complex. We are more than one thing, and all of the things that we are intersect and inform one another all the time. Our identities are not static. Many of them are constantly changing, constantly in flux. Some of them may never change, but many of them will. And our identities can give us privilege or not in different situations. And when I say in different situations, that can be the room that you walk into. Room to room, your privilege and your identity can change depending on who's in that room. So if that's true of us, I also want us to remember that our students come to us with all of these identities, just like we do. And so how do I make space in my classroom and in my mind for my students to be many things at once? To be not just the student in my math classroom who drives me crazy, but to also be the student who loves English class, who loves to sing. How do I see them as more than one thing? So this is one of those stop and reflect moments You're welcome to use the chat window. If it's reflection, meaning you don't want the question answered, please indicate that somehow. What's one thing you're thinking and one thing that you're wondering right now? So take about a minute to sort of process a little bit. Okay. So we have kind of a common ground understanding of identity. Now let's talk about math identity. In just a second, I'm going to put a definition up on the screen of math identity, and it's cited where it comes from at the bottom of the screen. I want you just to think about, and feel free to use the chat window for this as well, what words or phrases jump out to you, and then how do those words or phrases relate to your own experience as a math learner and user? So mathematics identity refers to the dispositions and deeply held beliefs that individuals develop about their ability to participate and perform effectively in mathematics to change the condition of their lives. Mathematics identity encompasses a person's self-understandings and how they are seen by others in the context of doing mathematics. Therefore, a mathematics identity is expressed in narrative form as a negotiated self, is always under construction, and results from the negotiation of our own assertions and the external ascriptions of others. What phrases jump out to you, and how do you connect with them? So in this particular format, oh, here we go. Thank you for using the chat window. In this format, it's a little bit difficult to sort of hear from you. So let me share with you, and I'm seeing some of the kind of things that you're saying here. So here's what jumps out at me. This idea that the beliefs that we have are deeply held around our math identity. How do I know they're deeply held? Meet anybody new and tell them that you're a math teacher. And then you get their whole history of mathematics, be it good or bad. Oh, I love mathematics. And then the whole story comes. Oh, I was never any good at it. And the whole story comes. And you don't have to reach very far for it because it's so deeply rooted. But these are the beliefs that develop, which means we're not born one way. They develop over time. There's a piece of it that's how we're seen by others that matters. So not just, oh, I'm struggling with this problem. It's how do other people see me as I'm struggling? How do I think they see me? This idea that it's a narrative form, that it's always under construction, there's this idea of negotiation. So when I hear narrative form, that makes me think it's a story that's always under construction. It's a story that's being written. And when we say negotiation of identity here, let me give you an example of that because that's a hard one for me to wrap my head around as a white, heterosexual, English-speaking Christian in the United States of America. I have all of these sort of identities that are considered dominant ways of being, and negotiation is a little bit foreign to me. So you saw a picture of my husband. He is 6'4", and he is 6'4" all the time. That's an identity that he cannot change, and he knows that he's about on the cusp of where research says people get uncomfortable around people that tall. So he can't change his height, but he can negotiate it. So what this means for him is that if he's in a socially appropriate situation, he will sit down as quickly as possible so that he is eye level with people, so it makes them feel more comfortable. He smiles as quickly as he can, partly because he's a happy guy, but also because when he smiles, it makes you feel comfortable, it makes you feel safer. But then he also does this thing, and if you know sort of tall, broad people, you may have seen them do this. If he can't sit down, he has to make himself feel smaller, and what he'll do is he rolls his shoulders forward. And I don't quite understand how it works, but it makes him feel smaller. And so while he can't change his height, he can negotiate it. And that's what I mean when talking about a negotiated identity. So, math identity goes deep. It's shaped by the perceived opinions of others. And then it's a story that's constantly being written. So that's what I'm talking about when I say math identity. But why does it matter? Like, who cares? Why are we having this conversation? Well, Carol Dweck, who's done a lot of research on mindset, would tell us that this is a very big deal because how we see ourselves determines the effort that we put forward. Now, this quote here is from a researcher named David Stinson, who did a study called Negotiating the White Male Mass Myth. And in that research, he went back, he was a middle school teacher, and he went and found some of his previous students who have gone on to college and to be successful in their career, African-American men. And he interviewed them as to what were the factors that you think helped you to succeed when some of your other classmates have not. And here's him speaking of one of the students. But this student simply identified himself as an African-American man who could succeed, who could meet and overcome obstacles. He looked at himself as one who could meet a challenge head on, able to succeed against any odds that came his way. He just saw himself this way. And because he saw that himself as someone who could overcome obstacles, obstacles weren't a problem. And now it's important to understand this idea of power and privilege are connected to identity. So we have to ask the question, how does a math person have power and privilege in the world? And I think about this in small ways, and I think about it in big ways. So for myself, I identify as a math person. And we'll talk about how I got there in a minute. But this manifests itself in ways like when I'm out with friends and the bill comes and we have to split it, and they all turn to me. And it makes me wonder, boy, they're giving me an awful lot of power in this situation. What if I had told them all the wrong answers? Would they take it for granted? They might. And then I just tell them that, really, I am not very successful at mental math when you're all staring at me, so they drop the subject. But in bigger ways, when I walk into a conversation about buying a house or buying a car or investing for the future, the mathematics doesn't frighten me. And so I have a different position entering that conversation. So the person on the other side of the table is going to know that they're dealing with someone who can ask questions and understand what they're saying back, so you're not going to get one by on me because I feel powerful around the mathematics. So that's what I'm talking about with power and privilege connected to math identity. So we've defined it. Now let's talk about how it's shaped. So I'm going to talk about three ways. Identities are shaped in lots and lots of ways. We're going to talk about three. The first is this. It's shaped at home. It's kind of the first place that we begin to learn is at home. And if you are a teacher, if you've ever had a parent-teacher conference, you've probably had the experience of sitting across from a parent who has said to you, well, I was never any good at math either. As if math was this inherited thing, as if it was a gene that you either have or you don't. And, well, I don't have it, so I didn't pass it on to my kids, therefore we can't do math. But the other side of that is what David Stinson was talking about in his study. He was referring to one of his students. And this idea that this student said that doing well in math and academics was not a choice. It was an expectation that had been set by the father, the mother, and the siblings that came before. So this idea that in this family, we do math. So by virtue of being in this family, you will do math. And that's where my own story starts around math identity. Again, you never have to reach too deeply for someone's math story. And it typically revolves around long division, fractions, algebra, or whatever that means to a person, or negative numbers. That's typically where people come up with their math story. And mine is around long division. So whatever grade we were doing long division in, I remember that I could not make the right answer pop out of the algorithm. I want to be really clear. We weren't talking deeply and conceptually about division, because if we were, that would have made total sense to me, I think. We were just doing the algorithm. And I'm really good at replicating procedure normally. It's not a problem for me. But I just, there were just so many steps and I didn't see how they connected. I couldn't do it. So my mother decided that I needed help and took me to my grandfather, a World War II veteran, who said, we're going to do this. So we sat at his kitchen table. I remember it like it was yesterday, vividly in my mind. And he had one of those register tape things where you would write your grocery list and then tear it off. And we did long division problems and tore them off. I did another one and tore them off all day long. And when I would get one right, he would say, yeah, you got it right. Now do another one. And when I got one wrong, he would say, no, you made a mistake. Now do another one. And we did problem after problem, and it was exhausting. And I was crying, and my mother was in the other room, and she was crying, and my grandmother was saying, no, she has to learn this. So by the end of the day, it was dark outside, I think, when we left. I was exhausted with my tear-stained face, but I walked out of our house having two things really clear in my mind. Number one, I knew how to do the long division algorithm, because my goodness, I didn't want to sit through that again. So I knew it. I could make the right answer pop out. I could do the steps. But the second thing, and the more important thing that I walked away with that day was, in this family, we do math. And by virtue of being in this family, you will do math. And when you struggle, we're going to support you because we do math. And so that's how identities are shaped at home. Another place we see them shaped are in societal messages. Now, I want to be really clear about this image. I do not watch this show. I don't really know anything about this show. I'm not endorsing it or dissing it in any way. Please don't hear that. It's mostly the image that I want to analyze. So this is an image for the Big Bang Theory, and I think typically when I have these conversations with groups, my question is, who are the math people in this photo? And the responses are typically, well, the people wearing glasses are probably math people because math people are nerdy, okay? Or the men are math people. And maybe that one girl on the end on the far right, because she's not really dressed that well and she's not conventionally pretty, and we don't think about pretty girls as being math people typically in society, okay? I also hear, well, some of the guys have really out-of-date clothing. They're not really cool. They're not hip. So those are the things that we identify as a society as being math people. So those sound like things that we should aspire to be, words like nerdy, words like not hip, out of style. So I just interesting what comes up in those conversations. Let's look to the movies for a second. So we got Russell Crowe at the top, playing John Nash, because if you're a math person whose mind is so beautiful that very few can comprehend it, you're going to go crazy. What about Matt Damon as Good Will Hunting? This sends two really unfortunate messages. Number one, that your math ability is something that you have to hide. He runs around for much of the movie solving equations in secret. And also that math ability is something that you're just born with. At one point he says, do you have any idea how easy this is for me? He's just born with the innate ability. Then you have on the bottom there, the bottom left, Edward Dean Gomos playing Jaime Escalante in Stand and Deliver. Now, he is supposed to be a math person in this movie, but the message it's sending is that when you're working with people who aren't math people, you have to work so hard that you're almost going to work yourself to death because you have a heart attack in the film, right? And then my favorite image here is the one on the bottom right. It's Lou Diamond Phillips' Angel Guzman, and he's carrying three books. Now, if you know the movie, then you'll know that he's carrying three books because one is for his locker, one is for home, and one is for staying in the classroom for him. Well, why is that? Well, that's because he can never be seen carrying a book because this is how the rest of the world sees him. And that is not a math person. Well, then there's this. This image ironically came up one time when I was doing a Google image search for the term math person. Now, this is the first image that came up, and I immediately copied and pasted it because it made me laugh. But interestingly enough, this was associated with an article about math anxiety, but this is the image that they chose. Well, then there's this. This is an actual shirt that was sold at Forever 21 a few years back. It's pink, and it says, allergic to algebra. It's worth noting this was sold in two colors. This pink color and then like a Miami blue color, which makes me wonder, who are they marketing to? And what does that mean? This is an image. If you follow Marilyn Burns on Twitter, she tweeted this out a little while ago, several months ago. Now, I've had the experience of seeing my restaurant receipt with the tip calculated at the bottom. It's a courtesy. It's nice that they have it there for you. But this is new to me, this image that math is hard. Okay. It's really not, but okay. This one happens to be my very personal favorite. This is from an actual Land's End catalog from 2012. It ran with a series of ads, and its partner ad had the same bags, but they were in primary colors, and the bag that's front and center had a soccer ball stitched on it and then a name that's typically associated with a boy. I think it was something like Steven. And the tagline for that one said something about the bags being superhero strong. But now look at this one. These colors are colors we typically associate with more female identities. The name on the bag is a female name, a name we associate typically with girls. And the tagline is that the bags are light as a feather, but tough as long division. So the message is that Steven gets to be superhero strong, but Chloe struggles with long division. Well, then Facebook gets involved. And I'm sure we've all seen something like this if you follow people on Facebook. Even if you don't follow math teachers on Facebook, this kind of thing always seems to come up. Answer this if you're a mathaholic. Yeah, because words that end with a holic are always so positive. By the way, they've already told you you're probably going to fail because 73% of the people failed, even though it's just a computation problem. What about this? How I see word problems. Four pencils and seven apples. How many pancakes fit on the roof? Purple. Because aliens don't wear hats. Yeah, because math is something that's not even supposed to make sense. This one actually came up this past week for me in my Facebook feed. These are just simple logic problems, and simple is probably the wrong word, but these are logic problems that anyone can solve using sense-making skills. But they've already told you right here that 98% will fail, but if you get it right, you're a genius. So only 2% of people are going to get this right because they're geniuses. And then if you look at the very top, the person who posted this said, someone please restore my faith in humanity. Not one person has got this right. So they've already told you, you're not going to get it right. And then this one's sort of a classic for me. It's Letter to Jack, if you don't know it. It was a homework assignment that a student brought home where they were supposed to analyze the subtraction problem using a number line, and there was a mistake. They were supposed to identify the mistake and then write a letter to the fictional student named Jack who got it, telling them what they did wrong. Well, a student brings it home. They struggle with it. They ask their parents for help, and then the father gets upset. So here's what they say. Jack, don't feel bad. I have a bachelor of science degree in electrical engineering, which has included extensive study in differential equations and other higher math applications. We need to stop there for a second and hear the privilege and the power that's being yielded in those statements. This person just told you, I am a math person, and thus everything that is to come should be taken as law. It should be taken and heard as right. Then they go on to say, I can't explain the way this common core thing does the mathematics. Here's how you should do it. And then they do the algorithm. Now, they've already told you they're a math person, so what they're really saying is here that a math person thinks like this. And if you don't think that way, then you're not a math person. They also say, I solved it in under 5 seconds because math people can be fast. Listen to all the messages happening in this one letter. In case you're wondering, don't worry, a frustrated parent has received some intervention and is now on the path to better understanding. So we talked about at home when we talked about society, and if I left you there, it would be very hopeless, I think, because I can't change those things. and neither can you. We can try to influence here and there, but I can't change them. But let's talk about where I do have some real influence, and that's what I'm doing in my classroom. So what you see here in this little screenshot is an actual picture of a worksheet that I created to work with sixth graders years ago. I was an intervention teacher, and the core classroom teacher had asked me if I would work with some struggling sixth graders on my very favorite thing, long division, and I said, sure. This is a really sort of classic I do, we do, you do structure, because early on in my teaching, I got very good at teaching like that. I'm in a different place now, but that's where I was then. And I made a whole series of these sheets, and I was using lots of different kinds of numbers, so two-digit divisors, three-digit divisors, things like that. And what I was going for in this particular one were common divisors, divisors that students could use some sense-making around, like 10, 11, 12, 20, 25, where they could have sort of real-life points of reference for them. I meant common divisors, but what I said was easy divisors. And what I thought about years later when I pulled this up and saw it again was, what was I doing to the students who struggled here? What were they thinking about themselves when they were struggling with the ones that were, quote, easy? Joe Bowler has a lot to say about this. She talks about, we want to have our students to have a growth mindset, but how can students have a growth mindset if they think of math as a fixed subject? Can everybody hear me okay?
I can hear you.
Okay, thank you. Just checking in, I saw that somebody had a question. Okay, so Joe Bowler talks a lot about how do we think about math with a growth mindset if we see it as a fixed performance subject. And this idea that we need to dissociate math ability from speed. And that time tests are the beginning of math anxiety. Now, my story here, it's not my story, it's one of a colleague. I was working with him a few years ago, and he had a six-year-old son. Now, it's worth noting that my colleague and his wife are people that are very much about growth mindset, and I believe that it's the way they talk and live their lives with their children. His six-year-old son comes back 3 or 4 weeks into first grade and says, Dad, I'm not good at math. And he says to him, well, boy, how do you know you're not good at math? And his son said, we had a test today with all these problems on it, and we had to do it in 2 or 3 minutes, and I didn't get all the problems done. 6 years old, and this student has decided that he's not good at math because of something that we as a culture do as a common practice. Now, again, my colleague and his wife know how to handle and navigate that conversation. His son is just fine, but that's the story that broke my heart whenever I heard it. Let's have sort of a broader conversation about depth of knowledge and math standards really quickly. If you're not familiar with this particular image, this is Webb's depth of knowledge wheel. Think about it as Bloom's taxonomy, just arranged into kind of a different shape. There's more research behind it, but that's sort of the nuts and bolts of it. You can see the verbs are there. So there's level one, that's recall, things like memorize and calculate and define. Level two, skill and concept. We typically think about application being associated here, so things like graph, classify, cause and effect, estimate, compare. Level three is strategic thinking, so things like critiquing and hypothesizing and drawing conclusions and constructing. And then level four, extended thinking being things like design and synthesize and critique. Okay, so that's kind of the basis of it. So wherever you live, Common Core state or in a state that hasn't adopted the Common Core standards, very typically our state standards are written at a level 1, 2, or 3. That's about where they max out as level 3. It's where we ask students to sort of perform at these levels. And that's quite simply because level 4 is really hard to test on a standardized test. That's why our standards are written that way. So our standards tell us to teach there, but we know from years of research that if I want my students to think fluidly at levels 1, 2, and 3, I have to give them experiences at level 4 to sort of activate that thinking for those early levels. So let's talk about what happens in our classrooms. And when I say our or we, please know that I'm always including myself in that we, because I have been in my classroom. Even if you have not, I have been in my classroom and I know what's going on there. So we have these four depths of knowledge sections. For our advanced learners, these are students who are exceeding the grade level standard. I would argue that we typically give them all of the wheel because we say things like, you can handle it. You can do this higher level thinking. You're ready for it. So we typically give them all four of the sections. For our strong on grade level learners, what I mean by this is our students who are performing very well would be, quote, proficient on the state assessments. So that means that they're proficient at levels 1, 2, and 3. I would actually argue that we typically give them access at least to level 4, because if they're doing so well at levels 1, 2, and 3, we say things like, you're ready for some enrichment, for some extension. And so we give them access to that level 4, even if it's just a glimpse of it. Now, what about our struggling learners? Well, I would argue that we, and definitely including myself in this we tend to cut them off from everything except for level 1. Because we operate under a misconception that if students don't know their math fast, then they certainly can't do higher level thinking. They can't do algebraic thinking if they don't know their math fast. I know that I've done that in my own classroom. So, let's recap. Our state standards tell us that we have to teach at levels 1, 2, and 3. But we know that if we want students to be really strong in those first 3 levels, we have to give them experiences at level 4. But this is what we're doing to our struggling learners. But I think it's really important in this conversation that we just name it. Let's be honest, who are our struggling learners? Our students of color, our students in poverty, our students who don't speak English as their first language, and our students with disabilities. Let's just name who those students are. We've got lots of data to tell us that's who those students are. And so here we go. Here is how math teachers shape identity. The students who can perform at levels 1, 2, and 3 are math people. They're math people because they're meeting the expectations that I have set for them. They're proficient on the state test. They're math people. The students who can do deep thinking at level 4, they are math people. These are really deep thinking math people. And this is where our students who struggle, students of color, students in poverty, students in special ed, and our students who don't speak English, this is where we put them. Let's go one step further. In my classroom that's very good at me saying, here's an example, now you do it. Messages I'm also sending and reinforcing whenever I am the only voice of math authority in the classroom are that math people know the steps and they know exactly what to do because I just told you, here's how you do it. Here are the steps. That math people think this way, the way that I have showed you, because I am the authority and this is how I have done it. Math people have neat work because my work, when I'm modeling it for you, will always be neat. The math people don't struggle or make mistakes. And if I do make a mistake, I just say, what? Ha ha. Just seeing if you were paying attention. Because you didn't see me the night before trying to make sense of that problem and making mistakes. It's also super important to note that when mine is the only voice of mathematical authority, I might also be reinforcing the idea that white people are math people, that middle class people are white people. So, before we move on, I need you to dump your brain out so that you can hear me as we move forward. So take a moment. Here are some reflection questions. In the chat window, on your own, however you want to do it, take about a minute, pick one or two or a few of these, and go ahead and just reflect. Just dump your brain out for a few seconds. Okay. So it's probably not enough time, but we have to move on. So if I left you there, if that's where we stopped, if that's where we ended things, it'd be a very hopeless conversation to send you off before your break, into your break with. So let's do a quick review. Math identity goes deep. It's informed by a very long history, and it can change, but it's not fast and it's not easy. It's shaped by the perceived opinions of others, which means expectations matter. And then it's a story that's constantly being written, and herein lies the hope, because it's a story that can change. It's not ever finished. And here's the good news. We, as teachers, help to shape math identity. And identities can change, which means we can help change math identity. And so let's talk for a minute about how that can happen. Now, I'm going to talk about a narrative under construction, but you've heard my math story, and it's not really that deeply under construction right now. The one that's most at the surface for me right now is my identity as a runner. So that's the story I'm going to tell. And I promise I'll make a connection back to math identity for you. So here's my story. Years ago in high school, I had this belief in ninth grade for no particular reason that somewhere in this body, no matter what this body looked like, I was a runner. But I never really did anything about it. And then came three people into my life that helped to profoundly shape that. So the first is on the far left. That's me several years ago in Buffalo, New York with my trainer. His name is Pat. In that picture, I'm 10 years older than he is, I think. He's probably about 20, 21 in that picture. And I met Pat at a time in my life when I decided I wasn't just going to have the gym membership. I was going to do something about it. So I started working with Pat, and I was his very first client ever, I think. And one day we were doing some strength training, and we knew we were going to do some cardio afterwards. And he said, you know, for your cardio today, I think we're going to jump on the treadmill, and I think I'm going to have you run. And I said, oh, no, I can't do that, and started giving him all of these phrases that sounded very runnery about why I couldn't do it. And he looked at me with a very puzzled look on his face, and he said, great, then that's exactly what we're going to do. And so with some scaffolding, we jumped on the treadmill, and he scaffolded me, and after about 20 or 30 minutes, he turned the treadmill off, and he looked at me, and he said, well, now you know you can do that, and he walked away. So that kind of resurfaced that idea, maybe there's a runner in this body somewhere. Flash forward to a few years later, and I was having dinner with the woman in the middle. Her name is Tiffany. She works in Minneapolis Public Schools. We were having dinner. It was one January evening, and I had confessed to her that I had this belief about myself that somewhere in this body there's a runner. And she said, great, let's do a race. And I started giving her this list of excuses about how I needed to lose about 900 pounds before I could ever be a real runner. And she looked at me and she said, if you can walk 3 miles, you can run 3 miles. Let's do this. And by the end of that evening, I had signed up for my first 5K. That's a picture of the two of us after that first race. And now flash forward a couple of months from there, and Tiffany wasn't with me in this race. I was there by myself trying to figure out where do I line up, because all of the pace signs that I saw didn't match my pace, which was slower than those. And I started chatting with a woman. Her name is Megan. You see her there on the far right. And she ran with me in the race. We were just sort of talking and chatting the whole time. And then she said afterwards, hey, I'm part of this running group. You should check it out. You'd be great there. You'd fit right in. And I went to the running group the next week. And then she very quickly became my regular running buddy, and we're friends. And she's been with me ever since. And so this is where this goes. So it starts in ninth grade, and it took these three people to get through this. That was my very first 5K. Then there were a few more races, then a few more. And then the one on the far right there in front of the lake, that's me after I had finished my first half marathon this past May. Now, I have done a half marathon. I finished it. I finished it in the time that I wanted to finish it in. And so some would call me a half marathoner. And what I fight constantly is this idea of speed and this idea of frequency, this idea that, well, I'm not a runner because I'm slow. No, you're a runner because you run. Well, I'm not a runner because sometimes things get stressful and I haven't run in 2 months, but can I still be a runner if I haven't run in 2 months? You are a runner because you run. So this is the narrative that's under construction for me right now. So let's talk about how these three people, though, profoundly reshaped this identity for me. And it lies in this. Number one, they gave me challenging tasks. They reminded me of what I could do, and they supported it with evidence. And they got to know me and made decisions and recommendations based on what they knew about me as a human, as an individual. So, okay, how does this connect to our math classroom? Let's start with this one. They gave me challenging tasks. Pat didn't take my excuses as meaning I couldn't do it. He didn't take my past failures as meaning I couldn't do it. He said, you will do this. And I did. Tiffany didn't say, well, let's wait till you lose 900 pounds. She said, nope, today, right now, we're going to set a goal and we're going to aim for it. They gave me challenging tasks. So what's that look like in a math classroom? It means we're going to go deep with the mathematics. We're going to give all of our students access to all levels of depth of knowledge, and we're not going to assume that lack of some things in level one means they can't do deeper level thinking, because that's not true. They absolutely can do that level of thinking. We're going to leverage multiple mathematical competencies. That means that some of the things I'm seeing in the chat, things like low floor, high ceiling, lots of entry points. I don't want to create a barrier my students have to jump over just to enter the conversation. Multiple ways of solving, not my way, our ways of solving. And mistakes as opportunities for learning. Because mistakes must be part of the process. It's where our brain grows. So Tiffany and Pat and Megan, they reminded me of the things I have done in the past, and they supported it with evidence. You can do this. Pat said to me, remember all those things you couldn't do when we first met, and now you can do them? You are strong. This is just one more thing you're going to get strong at. Megan said to me, remember when running 3 miles was a really hard thing for you to do, both emotionally and physically? Now we just call that Tuesday. So in my classroom, I'm going to affirm their identities by praising their effort, not their ability. And it's not just ending even at that. It's, okay, what have you tried? What will you try next? Maybe let's try this next. Because you can. Remember when long division was really, really hard for you, but you worked at it, and now it's very easy for you. This is the same thing. We're starting a new journey with a new concept. You will get there. And we're going to connect the students. They're thinking that they're doing to what math people do. You know that thinking that you just did today, that problem solving? Engineers do that every single day. And you know what that tells me? That tells me that being an engineer is not out of your reach. You can do this. And finally, they got to know me, and they made recommendations based on me personally, what they knew about me as a human. And so Pat sends me into a class at the gym, and I have a terrible time with it, and it was embarrassing emotionally. It's hard. So what does he do? He doesn't say, you don't have to go back. He says, here are some other clients of mine that look like you, that are where you are on your journey. I'm going to send you all in together, and we'll be powerful together, and you'll feel more comfortable. Megan was constantly saying, I know that you have trouble with this in your running. Maybe try these two things to help correct it. So for our students, we're going to challenge those spaces of marginality, which means that we're going to say, in this classroom, we do math. By virtue of being in this classroom, you do math. The mathematical authority in my classroom is interconnected and shared. I don't own it. We will come to it together because you all have rich identities and experiences that will add to this conversation. And we're going to draw on those rich resources that our students are bringing with them. Make space for them to be more than one thing. And we have to make connections between who they are and what they're doing in our classroom. This is a quick diagram if you're interested in doing more reading, as I think I saw a few people say. This is a great article. I referenced it at the end. Cassie Allen's a researcher in Oregon, saying very similar things to what I'm saying. This is just her framework for it. So here's what I want you to recognize, and this is sort of the piece to walk away with. When my friends gave me challenging tasks, when they reminded me that I could do it and they supported it with evidence, when they got to know me and made those decisions and recommendations based on what they knew about me, I got to know me because I discovered a new part of myself. And then I got to rename, reframe, and redefine who I was. I'm not the fat girl on the course. I'm a runner on the course. By the way, if you've ever experienced that journey, that's a really hard one to take. But because of them, I was able to do that. So here are the questions I want you to think about as you leave. How will we help our students get to know who they are? How are we activating this new identity for them? How am I helping to reframe and redefine who they are? How am I helping them with that? And I got to tell you, this journey, as I said, going from being the fat girl on the course to a runner on the course, that's a really hard journey. It's not a comfortable one. It's one I still struggle with today. And so I want you to ask this question. What discomfort and learning am I willing to experience for this? What are you willing, what discomfort are you willing to stand in for your students? And that's where I'm going to leave you, and I'll let Sheila see if there are questions we want to discuss. I know there were people that were asking about what are some resources. These are the resources that I referenced throughout this presentation. It's all here for you. If you've got others that you like, please feel free to share them. You can tweet at me. I'm at NicoleBridge1. And I'm really glad that you're
so much, Nicole. I'm echoing what I saw in the chat. This is the second time I've heard it, and I feel like I learn something every time I listen to it you present. The only question that I really saw was the one about references. Is there anyone else who has any questions they want to ask right now at the end? I have like 2 minutes technically. The chat will stay open. So if you're having a conversation with someone you want to continue, I think it stays open for about another hour after the meeting. So we have a question about math autobiographies. I'm going to go ahead and stop the recording. And so, like, I guess I'm not really sure what the question is. It's just, I guess, what do you think about them? How do you use them? Do you use